Hi there, it's Andrew Doyle here. Before we get into this week's show, I just wanted to let you know about the new daily newsletter from Spiked, which is called Today on Spiked, does what it says on the tin. And with that, you'll get a roundup of all Spiked's content each day, plus you'll get exclusive commentary from the Spiked team. So make sure that you never miss an article. Go to spiked-online.com/newsletters to sign up. Thanks very much. Hello and welcome to Culture Wars with me, Andrew Doyle. Today I'm joined by Thomas Chatterton Williams, an American writer whose most recent book is Self-Portrait in Black and White, Unlearning Race. I very much enjoyed Thomas's book, so I was really looking forward to getting to chat with him, and it was every bit as enlightening as I expected it would be. Thomas articulates a vision of the future which is far preferable to the divisive and hyper-racialized society that is advanced by practitioners of critical race theory. He's making arguments about race which shouldn't be controversial, but for some reason are. We discuss his book, how he came to his present understanding of racial politics, and why defending liberal values has become so difficult in today's climate. I hope you enjoy the episode. It's good to talk to you. I wish I'd spoken to you before because I've only just read your book, and I'd recently written an article about memoirs and autobiographies and that kind of thing. And I wish I'd have read that first because I would have really liked to talk about it. I think it's a really fantastic book. I think what's particularly striking about it is that you take this one moment from your life, this very key moment, which radically changes your whole perspective. Do you want to tell the listeners a bit about that? I don't think it's a spoiler because it's right at the start of the book, but if maybe talk them through that and then we can discuss.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm almost 40 years old. I grew up in New Jersey in the United States with a black father who's old enough to be my grandfather from the segregated South and a white mother, evangelical Christian from Southern California. My parents were married in the early 70s, only a few years after that became legal for blacks and whites to marry nationwide. And I was raised really, my brother and I were raised with the all-American concept that a drop of black blood makes a person black because race is binary. And whether or not it's biologically real, it's categorically enforced. So there's no real point in questioning those boundaries. So even though I had a white mom, we considered ourselves a black family, and I didn't really have such a complicated notion of my racial identity until I was in my late 20s. Found myself married to a French woman who, it started to dawn on me, had blonde hair and blue eyes like my mother. And I began to realize that I would be probably pushing my idea of the one drop concept of blackness to its limits when we had children, which is what actually turned out. This moment that you describe is, I think, the moment in 2013 when my daughter Marlo is born in Paris. Mm-hmm. And I'm holding my baby, and I eventually am, you know, I'm coming to the conclusion that race is a fiction. It's very difficult to believe you are a different race than your own child.
I think it's when you hear the doctor calling that she has blonde hair.
Yeah.
You know, and of course you had written an article not long before talking about how your children would be black. In fact, hadn't you made the point that all mixed race families ought to perceive their children as solely black?
Yeah, I had. In 2012, I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times arguing that it was kind of a moral duty, an obligation. There was a necessity of a kind of racial solidarity, even mm-hmm. for people that challenged our notions of blackness, that it would be harmful for them to leave the group. And, you know, I wrote this a year before my wife got pregnant. And in retrospect, I realized that I was writing that op-ed as an argument for an audience of one. I was trying to convince myself of something that I think deep down I suspected would be not so clear-cut a case.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. So there's this one moment, and the change is very, very radical because, like you say, you'd always identified as black growing up, that this hadn't been something that had ever occurred to you, even though you had parents of different races.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And I also want to stress that, you know, the culture changed too. I mean, I was born in 81. It wasn't until the year 2000 that you could legally choose more than one box on the U.S. Census. So I was actually in college. I was fully an adult. I could vote by the time that I could choose the black and the white box. Prior to that, you had to be either or. So I never grew up with a real robust sense of mixed race identity the way that I think many more people do now.
And to what extent do you think that was influenced by your parents? I mean, you say that your father was an old father, which meant that he would have lived during the Jim Crow era. He would have had memories of it. And therefore, the fact that your parents married must have been quite a shock at the time. Am I right in thinking?
You are. I mean, it was an act of love, but it was also in many ways a political act. I mean, my mother basically made the decision that she would leave her social world behind because she didn't she didn't believe in the values that would prevent her from marrying a man that she respected and loved based on the color of his skin. My father had, you know, issues in his own social world. So basically my parents left where they came from and created a new family on their own in a different part of the country. They moved across coasts. And, you know, my father's a sociologist by training, and he's a pretty erudite and thoughtful guy. He'd never believed that race was biologically real. He didn't believe in bio-race or scientific racism, but he did believe that there were certain strictures in place in American society. And, you know, I understand how he did. He was, I believe, 27 before the water fountains became desegregated where he's from. You know, he was fully an adult before he could ride in any seat in the bus. So race was something that harmed my father in his own life. He was unable to buy real estate in certain parts of towns, you know, unable to get a deferment from the military when the draft board in Texas told him, quite frankly, that niggers don't get deferments.
It's astonishing to think that this was that recent, isn't it? Because the stories like that really do remind me of the extent of the progress that has been made. And yet more and more I come across this sense from people that things are worse than they ever were. And that just isn't true.
I mean, I spend a lot of time thinking about that very question. That is not true. My father and I lived in two different Americas. Don't want to sound like a Panglossian kind of fool, but I think that we really have to be clear-eyed about what has been achieved. There is an element of the fact that it requires a certain amount of comfort to begin to complain about very small inconveniences that, you know, in previous times would not have even drawn much attention because there was real discrimination and racism going on.
Yes. When discussions about the relative progress that's been made, when these discussions happen, a lot of people will say, well, then you are denying that racism exists today. And nobody is denying that, of course, and that there are still horrible injustices that take place. But a recognition of the achievements of the civil rights movement, of social liberalism as a concept, is something that I think surely must help us to come together and get over our difficulties.
I don't see how you can ever achieve the society you say you want if you can't accurately and dispassionately measure how close you've come to it.
Yes.
Like the constant need to proclaim that America is static, that even, I mean, this argument is extending into Europe too. It's not just an American argument anymore, that white supremacy is a permanent fixture of the architecture of the planet. These are things that actually, I think it helps a very small group of elites and people who become elites, that kind of rhetoric can be useful in redistributing recognition and status and power. But that does not help actually poor and oppressed people who continue to be disproportionately Black and other minorities. That doesn't lift somebody out of poverty, that kind of rhetoric.
So let's talk a little bit about the sort of central thesis, I suppose, of your book. You mentioned actually at one point, and you almost mention it like it's a cliche and you're almost ashamed to bring it up, the idea, because you say that everyone mentions the taxonomies of race that were formulated in the 18th century by the likes of Carl Linnaeus. And you mentioned this, but actually I think it's very important that you do mention that race is a relatively recent concept. And that is not to say that people didn't see differences in human beings, but that the taxonomies themselves are relatively recent.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's really relatively recent in the scheme of even civilized life. I mean, it's 400, 500 years old, coming out of Germany and Sweden and a few, you know, scientific circles in Europe, and really having to do with the collision of Europe and Africa in the slave trade and the domination of a certain class of people in the New World for forced labor. I mean, it's really important to keep in mind that conceptions of monolithic whiteness are much more recent than that. In America, 100 years ago, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants did not fully accept that they were part of the same race as Mediterranean Italians and Greeks or Jews. I mean, Celtic peoples were considered a completely inferior race to white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in England. Now we've kind of melded into these abstract color categories that homogenize all difference, and it's really, really new.
So what you're suggesting, I suppose, is given that this is relatively recent, we can, as you put it, unlearn race, that we can transcend it. Is that something that you feel that is likely, I mean, just to play devil's advocate a little, I mean, if you think about the reality of living in 21st century is that there is a thing called race. You know, whenever I'm attacked online, people often remind me that I'm white. I think they see that as an insult. You know, race is always, is very much there for a lot of people and a lot of people's experience, particularly if you've been the victim of racism, for instance. So in order to transcend race, as you suggest, don't we need to solve those problems first? And won't that take a recognition of racial difference?
Well, it's a very important question. I think it's very important and necessary to insist that racism is real, that racism exists in the world, whether or not there are biological races, which we mostly agree there are not. I don't think it's likely. I think it's very difficult to imagine a world where we transcend these superficial differences. But anything that has been learned can be unlearned. Anything that has been acquired and was not always there, we have to proceed from the logic that, that the world could be otherwise. It's not an inherent aspect of our reality. To get to the place I want to get to, I think I've become more aware, even since the book was published, that there's going to have to be forms of material redress for certain communities that came through systems of oppression like slavery. I think that that has nothing to do with blood and skin. That has to do with belonging to a certain lineage of people that were stripped of rights and the ability to acquire certain footholds in America by the government until as recently as the mid-1960s. I think that some form of reparations probably has to happen. You probably cannot transcend racial divisions so long as racial divisions are grafted on top of class divisions.
Right. So the reparations question is very tricky, isn't it, in many ways, because it comes down to determining who has been directly disadvantaged and how far back you take that. Because, of course, you could say someone descended from Irish people should be eligible for reparations similarly because their ancestors were oppressed. How do you make those distinctions? How do you make those? How would you do that?
Really impressive scholars like Sandy Darity at Duke University, who have been devoting quite a lot of time to figuring out how specifically that could work. I don't claim to be an expert in that area, but I do think that you really don't have to go back to slavery. Someone as old as my father, who's 83, you can find a lot of people still walking around who were unable to acquire property in certain ways that was racially systematized and that the government participated in. So the knee-jerk reaction to conversations about reparations is like, I didn't oppress any black people. My family wasn't even here during slavery. Like, why do I have to give black people money? It's like, you don't have to give black people money. But the government did make it so that certain GI loans and things like this and certain access to neighborhoods was not extended to certain people who are still alive. So the government actually has to make good with certain citizens and their descendants in the country.
I think that's probably the strongest argument for reparations. I think once you go back to ancestry, reparations would probably be due to everyone in some way or another.
I mean, if you look at how the country was founded, how violent it was, a lot of people had a pretty tough time in forging this new world. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the question of housing is one that strikes me as makes a lot of sense because the racial division, even within housing up until the mid 20th century, have actual impact now still. So you have a racist system that still, even if everyone within that system is no longer racist, would still have a racist effect.
Wealth tied to, you know, the ability to get inexpensive loans guaranteed by the government, that's the foundation of the middle class. That's how countless waves of immigrant groups were able to get a toehold in America. I think that that's a pretty clear-cut case that proponents of reparations have.
That makes sense. But of course, with all of these arguments, it comes down to extremes, doesn't it?
These things have to be talked about rather dispassionately, and we're very far away from that kind of conversation right now.
We certainly are. But I've always been persuaded of the view of that color blindness is actually a rather wonderful ideal. And by that, I mean not that we don't see that people are different, but that we don't treat people differently on that basis. You often hear people talking about if we could get to the position with race where we get with say redheaded people, we notice it, but we don't treat people differently. That, am I right in thinking that really what you're advocating is a kind of direct step forward from what Martin Luther King was saying in the I Have a Dream speech?
Oh yeah, I think it's very much in the same spirit. I mean, terms like colorblindness, now they get kind of derisive dismissal. But I think that when you look at what the ideas are behind that concept. It's nothing to dismiss at all. I mean, James Baldwin wrote very movingly about wanting, you know, the color of skin to mean no more than the pigmentation in someone's iris or hair. It doesn't carry any more biological importance than that. And so we could imagine a world in which your physical characteristics tell me as little as possible about who you are, where you come from, what you value, even what your culture is. The fact is that we live already in extraordinarily complicated multi-ethnic societies. You in the UK, me in France or America. I mean, the toothpaste is already out of the tube. It's not going back in there. So we're still using the kind of mental frameworks that come from societies that were much more homogenous than they are now. The truth is, if I walk down the street in London and I see a man who appears Pakistani to me or who appears of Jamaican descent, it really doesn't tell me what they're doing in London. Those physical traits are not very meaningful in telling me who this individual is, what his deal is.
Yeah, I've always felt this way. I remember reading Christopher Hitchens' autobiography, and he was talking about how when he had the press pass for the Senate, and it always asked him to state his race, and he refused to do it unless he could put human. And he makes the point that since we decoded the genome, there is no biological basis for differentiating us in this way, for categorizing human beings. And he comes up with this idea that although there are a million different subjective definitions of racist, the only objective definition is one who believes that there are human races. But that kind of idea would get short shrift now, wouldn't it?
Oh, it absolutely would. You know, one of the things that I think is going to be the biggest obstacle to getting to the kind of future that I would like to get to is the embrace on the anti-racist left of concepts of, if not essential racial identities, then something very similar to that, something almost on the level of an essence, a kind of unbridgeable identity difference that separates people of different backgrounds that basically seem to be what people have always meant on the racist right as human races. You know, it's this situation, this horseshoe kind of situation where the so-called anti-racists reaffirm the very same premises that the racists have always taken for granted.
I think this is my real worry, because I think what you're proposing is such a beautiful ideal. But then I read something like Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, in which the notion of colorblindness itself is marked out as a signifier of white supremacy, and quite robustly. And I've even seen, and to be fair, this might just be maniacs on Twitter, but I have seen people problematize Martin Luther King and say that he was an internalized racist for even advancing this idea. So when you have such hostility towards what is in effect the epitome of anti-racism, but in the name of anti-racism, how do we negotiate that? How do you navigate that?
I mean, it's really tricky. And I'll be honest, I was surprised by the backlash that I received. I published this book in 2019. It's just come out in France, where it's a much more straightforward and kind of uncontroversial thesis.
Well, it didn't strike me as controversial at all, but then that's, I suppose, because I have an innate sympathy with the concept. What has the reaction been then from, I mean, has it been particularly difficult from the black community or from the left? How's it gone down?
You know, I might not have the full picture of what people think about my own book, but in my experience, some of the most violently angry reactions have come from hardcore white progressives. You know, Andrew, there's something to it that I am not a sensitive person to racism. I don't think that I really suffer very much. But there is something that has the whiff of a kind of racism that I experience from white progressives who unleash on me or some other black writers and thinkers that they feel have become something like native informants or in-group contrarians, where they basically can expel all the racial animus they might have towards a black person on us, because we're the target that's acceptable to apply to. So I've had people basically call me an Uncle Tom and things like this, and things that are even nastier, but they'd be white critics.
I've seen that sort of thing from critics who aren't white. I've seen it from people like Kehinde Andrews, who will use phrases like coconut and Uncle Tom, and which seems quite vicious to me. And also based on this rather racist idea that all black people should think alike. But you're saying you're getting it from white people more predominantly.
On Twitter, I mean, where the kind of activist progressive left is dominated by a kind of white person that perceives that they know what the correct black view is and what's in non-white's best interest. And that anyone who deviates from that view, it's like, listen to all black people, listen to POC, except when they contradict me, and then don't listen to them at all because they're Uncle Toms, you know?
This is what I don't understand about the whole narrative of lived experience, because if we are indeed saying that lived experience is the be all and end all, why are we dismissing so many people's lived experience?
Because they're actually not interested in the multiplicity of lived experience. And it's not just white people. It's too easy to say it's just white people. But in my experience, the most vicious attacks have actually come from certain segments of the white left. But, you know, you have Ayanna Pressley, representative in the U.S. Congress, who said, you know, we no longer want black and brown faces who don't speak with black and brown voices. So when you really think about what she's saying, that's the kind of view that has gained a lot of traction in the mainstream. The idea that, you know, there was an article recently in the Washington Post where someone argued very seriously that, you know, incongruities such as the leader of the Proud Boys, this white supremacist group, is an Afro-Latino man. Well, he's just participating in what is now called multicultural whiteness. So we're getting to a place where you have white supremacy that's going to be populated by a lot of non-white people, actually.
You're listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. If you're enjoying the podcast, please make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can subscribe to the podcast on all the major apps, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. And if your provider allows you to, then why not give Culture Wars a rating and a review while you're there? It would really help other listeners to find us. Now, back to the show. There's a lot of confusion about whiteness as a concept, but I keep seeing accusations that people of color are enacting whiteness. So really, whiteness isn't even about skin color. And yet at the same time, it's all about skin color.
Yeah, in a way, we are getting to the world that I want, which is transcending racial differences, except we're keeping exactly the same framework of white supremacy and inherent victimhood in place. It's very strange, but we are in a discursive space where white supremacy is detached from necessarily having any biological, racial, or ancestral link.
Yes. So I think that's something where everyone can agree that, as I've said, that the idea of biological, racial differences are just immaterial. It's not, it's a culturally constructed phenomenon. We can move beyond it. But I come back to this point because I don't know how to deal with the sheer hostility of the identitarian left. It's not just about racial issues. It's about sexuality. It's about trans issues. The level of venom and viciousness. I mean, I just have to block them now because you actually cannot talk to people who are just shouting abuse and shouting accusations at you and telling you what you secretly think, even though you don't think any of that. And so therefore, how do we get those people? And the reason why I'm torn on this is because normally it's great to just ignore people who can't argue. But these people have so much cultural power and clout, and they are the people we're going to have to persuade to bring society back on track. How do we do that?
Yeah, well, you know, they may not be the people we're able to persuade, but it's the people who are watching them and who are taking their cues from them who are a much greater number that we have to persuade. I mean, I would say that, you know, if you want to be honest, race is not the most difficult setting on which to play the game. It's right. Gender and sexuality gets way more complicated and dangerous, especially online. And I think that, you know, how do we do it? I think you've hit on a pretty successful technique, which is through humor and irony and sarcasm, as opposed to trying to dissect in an earnest way all of the contradictions and logical labyrinths that they construct.
Yeah, but even that creates a lot of hostility.
Oh, it does. I'm sure it does. But a lot of people looking on who maybe don't speak up, you're getting a massive onlooker kind of effect where a lot of people see the absurdity.
Well, I hope that's the case. I mean, even, I like to point out the contradictions because they are myriad. And even things such as you mentioned gender and sexuality, but the same people who will say that gender and sexuality is completely fluid, completely open, will also say that you need to stay in your lane when it comes to race and you mustn't appropriate culture. And yet they don't see that this is contradictory. And that to me is quite funny.
Oh, it's like a perfect Venn diagram. People will tell you that there is no basis on which to draw distinctions of biological sex.
Yes.
Will also say that they don't want any black and brown faces at the table who don't speak with black and brown voices, as though there's an inherent black and brown voice. I mean, it's actually one of those things where it is quite depressing because you realize that the goal is not to actually look at our reality and try to come to the most dispassionate logical conclusions about what's going on. The goal is to use language as a way of kind of beating people into submission. And so there are different approaches for different topics. And the approach that works on race is to re-essentialize. And the approach that's working on sex and gender is to step out of essentialization. And so what actually happens is that, and I've never been able to unpack why, there's this kind of understanding in elite spaces and educated circles that you can't even explore the relationship between transracialism and transgenderism. That's just something that's offensive to both non-whites and to people that are non-binary, if you even try to make a comparison. So there was a philosopher that did this several years ago in a journal called Hypatia, Rebecca Tuval, I believe is her name. And just for bringing up the comparison, she became a kind of massive scapegoat and was almost canceled. She wasn't canceled, but I mean, it's astonishing to me that we wouldn't want to be grappling with what are the similar thought processes at play in both of these
situations. It feels like an arbitrary distinction, doesn't it? I mean, it feels like we certainly should be exploring it because it's the obvious logical endpoint of identity politics, surely. I mean, in America, obviously, you've had Rachel Dolezal, but there was also that case, was it Professor Krug? I think her name was Krug. But in her case, it was clearly a kind of cynical move, wasn't it? She was identifying as Black for career advancement purposes. Whereas Rachel Dolezal wrote a book in which she claims quite earnestly that she feels Black and that she is Black. And yet, and I don't think anyone has accepted that, have they?
Nobody accepted it, except I did see, and I wish now that I remembered the name of the scholar, I did see on Twitter when that story broke, there were some Black scholars who said, look, if race isn't real and we want to take seriously the idea that race is a social construct, then Rachel Dolezal can be Black. I did see that position advanced. And I think, you know, it's something that nobody wants to hear, but it is actually something that we should take a bit more seriously than we do. Rachel Dolezal has had several very important life experiences. She studied at a historically Black university. She has worked leading a historically Black organization, the NAACP. She has Black siblings and she has mixed race. Mm-hmm. By all the definitions that constructed me as Black, she has children who are constructed the same way. And she has done many things in her life to live with Black consciousness. And so it gets very tricky to really put your finger on why she has to be made an example of and punished for some of the same kind of things that people do that get them respect.
I think initially I did see a couple of people on TV. I think it might have been a CNN clip where people were saying, well, maybe you can. They were at least posing the question, maybe it's possible. But on the whole, it's just been general scorn, hasn't it? That's the thing.
Yeah, it's been scorn. And, you know, people make the comparison towards, like, you know, I think her story, it was breaking at the same time that Caitlyn Jenner was being celebrated on the cover of Vanity Fair. And it does seem that there's an element of cognitive dissonance there.
Yes, absolutely. So given that we've been discussing this idea of the hostility of the very people that we might need to persuade, I'm actually quite heartened to hear you say this, that actually it's not really about them. It's about the onlookers, you know, it's about the majority. And that is my consolation because I've been wrestling with this for a long time. And I do think that's the truth that because if we use the phrase woke, because it's just so commonplace now, but the woke are a minority, but they are in power. They're a powerful minority, you know, and by woke, I suppose, I mean, the identity obsessed left. But if we can just persuade the majority, the people looking on, then eventually their power will erode. I mean, is that probably the best way to approach it?
We're in very hyper-polarized societies, America even worse than Europe. So there is a kind of tribalism on the right that is operating outside of logic. I mean, there's no denying that. And there's a kind of polarized tribalism on the left that is also working against the tenets of liberal democracy. But there is a huge segment of the kind of mainstream middle, center left and center right, people who are exhausted by this kind of permanent war, who just want to get on with living decent, good lives. And I think that they are not extremely online. They're desperate for sane conversations and they want to have a better, they want to transcend these divisions. And I think that those are the people that we have to be having a long-term plan to talk to.
I think maybe one of the first things we can do then is get off social media, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, now you're talking in the way that my wife would want to be talking. Just get off of Twitter now.
I think you know, I mean, I've come to that conclusion, really, is that it is impossible to have those sensible conversations that most people want to have when the most extreme voices on both the right and the left are dominating the field. And that's what happens on Twitter.
Yeah, it's kind of structurally set up. The algorithm doesn't want the things that we've just said in the past 5 minutes we want. The algorithm gets what it wants, which is extreme takes. There's no nuance. Yes. You get the dopamine rush for dunking or for vigorously approving, but not for kind of talking dispassionately. You know, it's true. And you know, it's important to remember, I think it's something like 88% of all content on Twitter is generated by like 5% of users. And only, I think, 500 million people or something in the world out of 8 billion are on Twitter.
Yes, exactly. So it is not representative by any means. But something that has really struck me, I mean, I used to just ignore the sort of maniacs on Twitter. But I've recently this week been piled on by high profile academics, quite a lot of them. And the thing is, they all behave like 12-year-olds. And this has actually struck me as being, well, actually, this is quite frightening, because this isn't just some idiot at his house. These are people who are in positions of power, positions of authority and influence. And I can't tell the difference between them and some 10-year-old child who's having a tantrum, because all they can do is throw abuse. And I can't imagine, if I was at university seeing that my lecturer behave like that, I would just think, I can't respect that person. That's just preposterous. So it's because it's the powerful people. It's because it's those who are meant to be authoritative. I even had a professor at Oxford University so angry that I blocked him that he tagged in my publisher, because I've just written a book on free speech. He tagged in my publisher to get my book on free speech cancelled, presumably. And that's the infantile level of behaviour from people we're meant to be looking up to. So I just, it just makes me think social media's got to go, and maybe even the humanities are over. Maybe even universities are over. Am I being too pessimistic here?
I think we can't concede too much. I think we have to fight for the things that matter. You might be right that social media is toxic. I mean, I tend to agree with that view. But I also, there's a part of me that hesitates to cede that sphere entirely to the extremes. I mean, I think you have found an enormous audience, actually. And I've found an audience of tens of thousands of people that seem to not want the hyperpolarized takes either. So there is, even on social media, even in this cesspool, there is a kind of large audience out there for the pushback.
Yes.
And the universities we absolutely can't give on. That's actually pivotal. We can't give up on the humanities. We can't give up and concede conversations to the loudest bullies about no longer reading Shakespeare, about no longer reading anybody pre-1950. I mean, we have to actually fight for that. I think that is extraordinarily important.
I think you're right. I think on principle, we absolutely have to. But the problem is, because if we don't, they will win. That's just the way it is. But haven't they already won, I suppose, is my question.
I talk about this a lot, probably too much. I think we're in a 10 to 15 year struggle of ideas. I don't think they've by any measure won. And I also have hope with younger generations coming up who will rebel against this kind of prudish orthodoxy that's being pushed on them by their elders. I mean, if you think of like the Prohibition era or something like that, you know, or the rigidity of the 1950s, it's a permanent victory for that kind of Puritanism can't last. You know, there is no permanent victory for that stuff. I'm sure it's going to inculcate its own rebellion in the next generation. But I think that we have to always be there right now, showing another way.
It's music to my ears that you're saying this. It does make me feel this. It's so optimistic, so positive. And then I get back on Twitter and someone calls me a Nazi, and I just think, I don't know what to do with that. You know, because that person needs to go back to school. Oh wait, they're a professor at a university. You know, it's. And they don't know what the word Nazi means. I don't know how to cope with that, really. So what do you do? Because I always go back to people. If people criticize me in a polite way, I always engage, and I try not to lower myself to their level. But sometimes the comedian part of me kicks in, and you treat them like a heckler. And then, of course, I'm at their level. How do you deal with it? I mean, you say you've been getting these kind of things from particularly white progressives or so-called progressives. How do you respond when someone's just simply attacking you and isn't prepared to listen?
I have made the mistake of responding in the past, and I find that the best policy going forward is the people that really show they won't engage in a good faith debate of ideas, which I'm always down for, those people you can block. The people that attack ad hominem, you can block them. But I engage quite a lot of critics, and sometimes you can really reach some common ground, not always and not permanently, but you can have instructive back and forths that end in kind of, Twitter is capable of giving interactions that are not completely toxic. So I'm always on the lookout for those, and the cheap ones I block. But man, in July, we published a letter in Harper's Magazine with about 150 academics and writers and intellectuals who signed it, just defending the most anodyne values of liberal democracy, tolerance, freedom of expression. And one of the people that signed the letter, who's a friend of mine who I really admire, is a poet and writer and journalist called Dwayne Betts. He was 16 years old when he went to adult prison for being involved in a carjacking, a really unfortunate and, you know, dangerous activity that he engaged in that he fully took responsibility for. And during those 8 years in a very hard American prison, sometimes in solitary confinement, he taught himself how to write poetry. He read everything he could get his hands on. He ended up putting himself through a series of colleges, culminating in graduating from Yale Law School. I mean, he's been a fellow at Harvard. He's written some beautiful books. And he signed the letter, he said, because he's concerned about a culture that's increasingly unforgiving.
Yes.
He told me that, you know, after signing the letter, he was being called a fascist and a transphobe. And he said, you know, I had to get my dictionary out and I had to double check that I knew the definition of fascist.
Because, well, yeah, you know, they make you
doubt. This is so upsetting. It's so upsetting. But, you know, so I've been called these things too. We were called transphobes for the first couple of weeks after the letter because J.K. Yes. Rowling signed it. And there's this idea that you agree with every position that anybody who you associate with agrees with. And I'm not even talking about the validity of J.K. Rowling's critiques. I'm just saying that this idea of guilt by association, that's exactly the thing that we have to be pushing back against.
Well, these are such basic argumentative fallacies. You know, the idea of guilt by association, ad hominem attacks, the tu quoque thing, you know, just all this stuff that anyone who's done any basic work on critical thinking knows to avoid these things. And yet, the vast majority of opinion columns I read in the national press these days commit these basic fallacies, most notably intuiting the motive and secret thoughts of their detractors or opponents. That's something that people just can't seem to get over. And if people can't argue, if they can commit these fallacies and those fallacies don't mean anything anymore, then what? Where are we? I mean, I think the Harper's letter, I'm glad that you raised it because it was a completely inoffensive letter.
By design.
Yes. In fact, I wanted to ask you about this because am I right in thinking that you drafted the original version of that letter?
Involved in it. There were five of us who drafted. Right. I mean, we took in input from dozens of people. It was designed to be something that would be very difficult to disagree with if you were not some type of authoritarian.
That's right, because even at the start, I wondered about this, because the opening of the letter, really, there was quite a lot of Donald Trump bashing going on. At first I thought, okay, well, this might be polarizing, but then I realized this is a strategic thing, because what this does is it says, look, the defense of free speech and liberal values isn't just coming from the right, this is coming from the left. Was that the purpose of that political aspect?
I mean, absolutely. When you think about threats to tolerance in our society, and the society is helmed by Donald Trump, who actually does try to dismiss anybody whose views he doesn't like, and
yes,
who, you know, who has probably, as Sam Harris has pointed out, lied on record more than any human being in the history of humanity. I mean, you have to start by acknowledging that this is not something that exists on one side of the spectrum. But so we open by saying, look, Donald Trump is president. Let's not pretend. But then the conversation that we wanted to have is that the institutions that are supposed to stand up to this type of mess, they're failing us too. And they're giving
yes.
into another kind of authoritarianism and illiberalism. And that's actually very worrying, because these are the very institutions that are supposed to be the pillars of our democracy.
Yes, well, that's why I think it does two things. You know, firstly, it establishes the political affiliation, not even affiliation, but the orientation, shall I say, of the most of the signatories. But it also does draw an implicit comparison between the way that Donald Trump goes on, particularly when it comes to, like you say, the matter of truth, and what is happening amongst so-called progressive circles. And there are certainly overlaps.
Oh, there are enormous overlaps. And the French say les extrêmes se touchent, and, you know, extremes meet. And I think that, you know, Donald Trump was a big, big engine of wokeness. No, yes. I think it's taken on a life of its own, actually. I'm a little bit less optimistic than I was in November that defeating Donald Trump would naturally kind of quell these passions. I think that a Pandora's box has been opened, and I think January 6th kind of sealed in a process for the near term, at least, where he doesn't have to be around at all. He could die tomorrow, and these energies are out there. These furies are out there.
Hi, it's Fraser Myers here. I produce Culture Wars and all of Spike's podcasts. I really hope you're enjoying the show so far. This podcast, like all of Spike's content, is free. There's no paywalls or no paid subscriptions. We rely on the support of our loyal listeners and readers like yourself to keep producing our groundbreaking podcasts, interviews, articles, essays, and more. So, if you're a regular listener to this podcast and you're wondering how best to support it, please do consider donating to Spiked, or even better, becoming a regular donor. Even £5 per month can make an enormous difference. To start your regular donation today, just go to spiked-online.com and click the red donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and the red donate button in the top right corner. Now, back to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle.
One of my biggest worries is what you've touched on here, which is the notion of truth. I mean, when it came to Donald Trump, he would be perfectly willing to flat out lie about something he'd said the day before. And then I could go on Google and watch what he said, and everyone could do that. But he didn't care. He would just say, no, I didn't. He would just deny. But by the same token, the press were doing similar things. I mean, I read the report about what he said about the bleach, but the way CNN painted it wasn't actually what he said, or indeed clearly what he meant. So everyone was at it. The idea of truth becomes utterly meaningless. And I see this more and more in academics, particularly in higher education, that truth doesn't matter. It's what they decide is true. This kind of pseudo reality that they'd rather create. And just to make that sort of clear, for instance, if you're going to make the charge of systemic racism with any given institution, that is perfectly possible. I can accept that there can be institutions that have racism built into the core, but I've seen that accusation thrown at institutions that are clearly not systemically racist. For instance, Oxford University. The idea that Oxford University is systemically racist is a nonsense and is actually disproven by the data in terms of admissions and everything else. So why stick to the fantasy? And when people do, what do you do about it?
Yeah, this is a real serious problem that transcends the right-left divide. The idea that truth is something to be utilized in favor of a position, and that there's a standpoint truth. There is no shared truth. And so therefore, once you get into the kind of disdain for objectivity that we've entered into on both sides, then anything becomes possible. You know, there's a whole, in my field, there's a whole conversation going on about the kind of ludicrous fantasy that we used to hold on to in the past few decades about journalism always striving to be objective, that objective itself is a kind of white standpoint. And so what we need is not objectivity, but moral clarity. Well, you know, ISIS thought they had moral clarity too. So that's not necessarily a straightforward improvement over the flaws that were there in so-called, you know, objective reporting. So I'm very worried about that. I think one of the solutions is that we have to create new institutions. We have to create new institutions that are outright committed to something that we're not getting in any of our polarized media right now. It's going to require money. It's going to require people coming together who are deeply, deeply troubled by what's going on and committed to nonpartisan truth-telling. I think it's possible. I've had quite a lot of conversations with people. People know that something out there is wrong. To your idea about how the argument around systemic racism goes, though, I'll just share this experience I had 2 weeks ago, because it was really some through-the-looking-glass argumentation. I was in a debate with another academic, and we were talking about systemic racism. And I said, well, you know, I just want to say that unlike Ibram Kendi or some people who argue, all discrepancies between groups cannot necessarily be attributed to racism. Yeah. And so I said, for example, I want to take Black Americans out of the equation for a moment, and I want to compare Asian Americans in New York City. Oftentimes, they're quite poor. They're of immigrant descent. Sometimes they're English as second language. And they absolutely dominate white kids of every tier on the entrance exams to the schools, elite public schools. There's an enormous discrepancy, but it can't really be described or attributed to a racism that favors Asian Americans over whites. And I said, so how would you describe that discrepancy? And the academic, I kid you not, Andrew, she looked directly into the Zoom screen and she goes, I got two words, systemic racism.
Amazing.
And I just said, well, we actually can't talk.
That's just a slogan then at this point. There's no, I mean, I've even seen a kind of sleight of hand where people have tried to suggest that Asian Americans should go into the white bracket.
White adjacent,
White adjacent, because then that enables them to keep. So the data absolutely doesn't matter. And the incoherence of the logic as well. I mean, if you think all unequal outcomes are evidence of discrimination, then surely the fact that girls have outperformed boys in schools and universities of the past 25 years in the UK means that there is a systemic anti-male quality to our education system. But they won't entertain that concept.
No, they won't. And, you know, talking about universities acknowledging that they're systemically racist, I mean, I believe it was Princeton that when the president published a letter, you know, to the community saying that Princeton was a systemically racist institution, Betsy Davis actually called him on it and opened an investigation. Because if that's the case, that's just beautiful. And then they were like, wait a minute, we don't mean like that. Because you're going to lose your federal funding if you're actually saying that you're a systemically racist institution in 2021.
Because it's illegal, right?
Yeah, it's illegal. It's on the books, actually. So, of course, it's just a rhetorical device that no one expects you're supposed to actually take literally. And that's what's so disturbing about it. When you actually call them on it, they don't actually believe they're systemically racist.
No. So I don't know how we get beyond this, because it is like dealing with a religious zealot at this point. You know, I see one of the examples I've written about before is when I saw a front cover of, there's a newspaper called The Guardian. I'm sure you've heard of it. It's a very kind of identity politics driven publication. It's an activist publication, really. And the front cover headline was "Revealed the Scale of Racism at Universities." But the data within the actual article itself proved that racism was vanishingly rare in UK universities. And it was almost like they were saying, look, there were these number of formal complaints. I think it was 1,000 formal complaints of racism across all these many, many institutions. So on average, in other words, there were only 1.5 complaints of racism every year in any given institution. So practically nothing. But they were saying this proves that lots of people are not coming forward about their racist lived experience. So that was the idea. And the headline should have been, this is great news. We've made such progress. Racism is almost gone in our universities. But the opposite was what they went with. Now, how do you even cope with that? And how do you cope with, you know, when you read Robin DiAngelo, and I mean, her view is that every human interaction, every institution is underpinned by racism. And you shouldn't be asking the question, is this racist? You should be asking the question, where is the racism here? And in order to back that up, she'll just quote other critical race theorists who believe the same thing. So it's just it's lots of different high priests quoting each other to give this illusion that what they're saying has any validity. How do you even begin to break that down?
The thing that you have to take into account there is that there's a circle of high priests quoting each other about the intractability of racism in the most elite spaces, and they're getting paid hand over fist
to tell
Fortune 100 companies this. So I think one of the things you have to do is you have to somehow convince the people that are supplying the gravy in the gravy train that they don't have to do this. Trader Joe's, for example, was called out some months ago for having a line of salsa called Trader Jose's. And they were told that they were racist and they had to repent. And, you know, on social media, there was a bit of a backlash. And the company just said, no, we know our customers. We know they don't think that's racist. And our Latino customers don't think that's racist. And we're not changing it. And this is not a real controversy. And it just, it blew over within 24 hours. It was over. They didn't change the brand. They didn't apologize. Nothing happened. It was all a bluff. And I think that as soon as something has to happen where the corporations themselves who are pulling the budget strings have to stop this cottage industry of making millions of dollars telling people how racist they are and corporations how institutionally racist they are, when the money stops, that will actually do a lot towards fixing the conversation as well.
I think that's right. And I've always had this feeling that the problem really isn't the people screaming for, you know, Uncle Ben's rice to change or whatever else. It's actually the people who capitulate to it.
It's always the people who capitulate. Always.
So how do we, I mean, the example that you've given is a, I mean, that it takes genuine courage, actually, I think. But as you've just outlined, it works if you ignore them or make fun of them, even, you know, that would be the way to do it. Certainly they would get my custom, any kind of company that does that. I think they might actually rise in popularity.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, Robin DiAngelo, she's telling corporations for $12,000 to $20,000 an hour that they're systemically racist because she herself, as a white woman, looks at black people and has racist thoughts. Essentially, what she's doing is monetizing her own personal racism. It doesn't tell us anything about the society as a whole.
Yes.
And also, yeah, oftentimes, absolutely, she's actually taking up space in the parliament. She's taking the position of a black woman or a Latino woman who could make the same case and oftentimes is paid less.
You would think that she would drop out. If she believed her own philosophy.
If she believed her own philosophy, she would give all of those lecture fees to one of the qualified women of color in her industry who are trying to get a foothold.
I've noticed that she doesn't have many combative interviews at all. Have you ever spoken to her?
Never. She doesn't do debates. I asked Ibram X. Kendi, who he has overtaken Robin DiAngelo as the go-to viewpoint.
Right.
I asked him directly. I was a fellow at Bard in 2019, and he came to speak, and I asked him directly the question about taking blacks and Latinos out of the conversation, just let's get through the systemic racism and Asians outperforming whites on these exams. And he just wouldn't respond to it. He said, immigrants don't count. The numbers are too small. That's not really what I'm talking about. And just no interest in actually trying to figure out what might be going on.
So would you say Ibram X. Kendi is more open to discussion? As in,
I would say that he comes down from the mountain with the Moses tablets.
Right, okay. I did read his book. I noticed that there were some actual distinctions between his view and Robin DiAngelo. For instance, Ibram X. Kendi believes that black people can be racist, for instance, and she absolutely does not.
But it's interesting. The examples he gives of black people being racist are internalized anti-black racism. So he shows himself being racist when he had any kind of critiques of black culture when he was a teenager. What's really interesting was there was a review of the two books before George Floyd. There was a review of Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist and DiAngelo's White Fragility in The New Yorker by Kelly Fasena. And Kelly Fasena finds this neighborhood bully who was a kind of minor rapper with 50 Cent in Queens in the neighborhood that Kendi grew up in. And Kendi says that when he was afraid of this bully who was extraordinarily violent, he realized that he had internalized anti-black tropes and was himself being racist. Kelly Fasena finds the guy who's been deported to Trinidad and Tobago for all of his crimes, and the guy believes that actually what he was doing was exercising agency, and he was really wrong and a bad bully, and it wasn't racist that he was actually responsible for his actions. And so it's mind-blowing. You know, I might be too in the weeds there, but for me, that's the perfect kind. The actual black figure that Kendi was trying to save from being responsible for his own actions disagrees and thinks that he was.
Well, I think one thing that Ibram X. Kendi and Robin DiAngelo do have in common is that they tend to take their own experiences in life and their own perspectives and project them on absolutely everyone else.
Exactly.
I think that's a flaw that they both have. I mean, his book has a memoir quality as well. You know, it's very different from yours, of course. I mean, he's taking various episodes throughout his life and tying them sometimes quite tenuously to things that are going on. And I think what was really impressive and commanding about your book is that it is almost a kind of Road to Damascus moment. It's that striking moment that just shifts everything. And I thought that was wonderful.
Thank you so much.
And I would urge anyone listening to have a read. Just to wrap up, it's been really great to talk these issues because it's nice every now and then to talk to someone who has such a positive outlook about the future, which is, you know, it's difficult to have in these times. And yet when I read your book, I can see that there is a way through, potentially a way through. I think one of the biggest problems we're going to face, and maybe you can help me with this one as well, is the language issue, is the fact that so many of the critical race theorists and the people who would seek to divide us, actually, they use the right language. They use clever language like anti-racism. So if we take the phrase anti-racism, I always would describe myself as anti-racist because I'm opposed to racism. And yet, now, I wrote an article for The Spectator recently where I made the point that in order to be opposed to racism, you have to be opposed to anti-racism, because I feel that the anti-racist movement is making society more racist, not less. Try explaining that to someone who isn't familiar with Kendi or the rest of them, and It's really hard. It's a hard sell.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Language is one of the fronts of contention that we really have to not concede. Conceding the term anti-racist is devastating, actually. So I think that there's a lot of work to be done to reclaim these words. Who wouldn't be anti-racist? Who that doesn't have time to kind of be really deep into the discourse, especially online, would say, you know what, I'm opposed to the new anti-racism. It's a marketing coup. He's branded, like, he's put a trademark on the term anti-racism while actually reinforcing the very categories he claims to want to counteract. Those of us who are extremely online and are deep in the discourse, we have to fight for these terms. We have to reclaim them. It's like saying, who's against goodness? Or who, it's crazy.
I often think this with Antifa, even, insofar as I don't know anyone who is pro-fascism. I also don't know anyone who isn't opposed to fascism. So everyone's anti-fascist, aren't they? I mean, you don't have to say that. I always get very nervous when someone says anti-fascist in their bio, because I think, you don't have to tell me that. That's a given. I'm just going to assume that, right? So is your answer then that we use the word anti-racism as it's meant to be used? Because the problem now is, if I do use the phrase anti-racism, people are going to think I mean Kendi's version of anti-racism. And I don't.
Right. It requires actually picking and choosing your terms carefully and defining them and defining when they're being misused. It requires work. This is not going to be easy. It requires explaining to people what is actually deeply racist, perhaps for different reasons and with different assumptions, but what actually ends up being racist in the anti-racist religious discourse that's kind of fueling this moral panic that we're all subjected to right now. We have to fight for these terms. I don't think it's easy, but I am optimistic. I think if you come from the Black experience in America, you really have no choice but to be optimistic. I really don't think the conclusion is to be pessimistic.
And do you think this is something you might explore in future books? It seems that the two books you've written are memoirs, really, I suppose, but with a broader cultural and political outlook. Are you a memoirist now?
I think my dad's going to kill me if I write a third memoir. So I think two before the age of 40 is sufficient. And I want to write something seriously, taking a look at what fuels illiberalism on both the left and the right, and how we can kind of transcend it.
I think that would be a very welcome contribution to the discussion. Thank you so much for your time, Thomas. I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You have been listening to Culture Wars with me, Andrew Doyle, and Thomas Chatterton Williams. Not to be confused with Thomas Chatterton, the ill-fated 18th century poet, although I really should have asked him about that, whether he was named after him. Inevitably, after all of these discussions, I always think of the best questions a little too late. Anyway, talking to Thomas really did cheer me up, quite genuinely, you know, because I've started to think that those of us who are on the side of liberalism and equality and free speech are sort of losing this battle a little bit. And he's reminded me that no, that's not the case. All is not lost. It's a long war. We've just got to keep plodding on. So I hope you got as much out of this conversation as I did. And make sure you like and subscribe and do all the rest of it. And join me again for Culture Wars. Farewell for now.